and we understand that although we may disagree politically or about something about religion or something about a social issue, we can still respect each other and still love each other. He knew what it was and he knew how it felt, and he sat there with me for a long time. We shed tears and he sat there and encouraged me. A lot of times guys say they don't want to go out like that, you know, having an injury, and I do feel that, but more importantly, I feel like I have unfinished business.
Welcome into the lounge. This week's lounge really was just me and Benjamin Watson, but we'll let you in for now to tape the beginning of this.
I'm stopping into the lounge for happy hour, and then I'm getting out before dinner starts.
I like the happy hour deal.
Yeah.
I can't argue with that.
Yeah. So Ryan is talking with Benjamin Watson in this week's episode. When this interview was done, I was out of town, so I appreciate you, you know, holding up your end of the bargain. It's rare. It's rare that that happens, but you did your job.
We seriously just got into a debate over lunch about how we have to pick up each other's slack when we're missing. I forgot about this one because it was like a crazy day. I think it was the Pitta injury. It was a nutty day. I'm running all over the place, and then Benjamin Watson comes up to my cube and is like, hey, you ready to tape that podcast? I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. Worst timing. It was, oh, whew.
Well, like I said, I'm glad that you held up your end of the deal, yeah. And you got it done, so.
Yeah, and actually, it was kind of nice that you weren't there because as listeners will hear, this got pretty political.
No, it didn't. I listened to it. It really doesn't get that political.
It gets pretty political.
You like to try to talk up like this big game that you're like coming in with the high
horns,
and you're coming in with these tough questions, and you're really getting down in the mud, and you're really challenging him. Well overstated. It's a good interview, mostly because of bed, but it's a good interview. But you're overstated.
And it got deep, which you like to stay surface level. I get personal. I get, you know.
It was deep.
Yeah, it was pretty deep.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're really teasing the hell out of this interview. But before we get to that, first we talked last week's episode about not having good enough fan emails.
Yeah.
Right, to really read one. Well, we got a great one.
We had some really good ones. People stepped it up this week.
That's right. So this one comes from Lauren Baker, who's from the Eastern Shore, and he's now living in L.A. So thank you very much, Lauren. And his question, well, why don't we just go ahead and play the tape?
Hey guys, two-part question here. One, I feel like in addition to Weddle, Jimmy's Seafood or Crab Cakes does a lot of great recruiting, offering crab cakes for life. And I'd just like to know if you've been able to talk to the players to see if they actually take advantage of the free Crab Cakes for Life offer. Pretty sure Mink would do so, maybe on a weekly basis or daily basis. I do so at least twice a week, so no shame there. But I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. Also, second question is that I'm a big Ryan Mallett fan. Have been since he was drafted. I think the guy got a raw deal down in Houston with an unneeded quarterback controversy, and seems like he really found a home in Baltimore, you know, filling in when Flacco was down, when we couldn't find a good QB to start, and beating the Steelers, actually looking better than Flacco typically does in that game, much faster with reads and everything else. And, you know, then, you know, the Bengals game was okay. We lost, which sucked, but, you know, he made a couple of nice comeback drives and stuff like that. So I feel like compared to a lot of the other quarterbacks in the league that Mallett could start for most teams, and just want to get an idea of what you think the long-term plan is there. Like, he's basically Flacco part two, except for incredibly more outgoing and has a really big mouth and everything else. But do you think he is someone that the Ravens are going to keep around for a long time, possibly trade, et cetera, et cetera? So thanks.
All right, so thank you very much once again, Lauren, for submitting the question. And you're absolutely right. I would be hitting up the Crab Cakes for Life on at least weekly.
Right.
Does it apply to your family? Because I'd have my wife in there. I'd bring a kid, friends, family, extended family, all that.
Yeah, well, the CEO of Jimmy Seafood, John Minidakis, I hope I'm saying his name right, but he did an interview with Glenn Clark from PressBox. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how no matter what, you know, if Jeremy Macklin were to come in there and say, I want 100 crab cakes, then you get that order. I mean, he said his word. Mm-hmm. And he said, you have free crab cakes for life. So however many crab cakes that includes, That's what he gets.
It sounds like Jeremy Maclin's going to make the most of it. I don't think he's going to be in there every week, but I think he's going to go in there a couple times, a few times, and eat a lot of crab cakes.
Well, here's the thing. So if you're a rich guy already, then
the
do
free
you,
doesn't
then
work
the free out. Doesn't. Now some rich guys they still like the free because everybody loves free.
It's actually true. We work with players all the time. They still love free stuff.
Yeah, everybody loves free. Everybody loves free. I mean, that I don't think you ever lose that. But I wonder if there's any, the fact that you are already a wealthy guy, that you can afford to spring for the crab cake wherever right. you go, I don't know if that's an incentive like for those guys like it would be for us. I would never have dinner at home again if I had the free crab cakes coming my way.
Have you ever done a food eating contest?
You know, when I was a kid, there was a place that we used to go to, like when I was in high school, that would do unlimited wings. And so we would go there and see who could eat the most wings. I think one time I got in the 40s, which is a good amount of wings.
Really? One time I used to work at the Washington Post, and there was this guy there who was just an absolute animal slash filthy creature, John Goldberg. Shout out to Goldie if you're listening. And one day I was just like talking with some coworkers. I was like, I wonder how many McNuggets I could eat. You know, I wonder if I could get 100, you know? So, of course, as soon as you say the words, I wonder if I could eat 100 McNuggets,
yeah.
Everybody in the office is like, oh, Mink thinks he can eat 100 nugs. Let's put your money where your mouth is. Come on, let's go. Let's do this. So, of course, me,
getting
the peer pressure. Yeah. I always came to peer pressure. And one night in McDonald's, took down me versus Goldberg. I ate 69 nuggets. He ate 78, and he didn't show up to work for 3 days.
No.
He yacked in somebody's lawn on the way home.
Did you keep down all those nugs?
I kept down 69 nugs.
Really?
I did.
Wow.
After 50, it gets rough.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Anyway. Ew.
Anyway, to answer
like you said, you're a really deep person, so a lot of depth going on there.
This conversation. To answer Lauren's question, Jerry Macklin's the only Raven, by the way, that has the free crab cakes for life offer.
Yeah.
So we don't really know if other players take advantage. I do think that Jerry will. And to answer Lauren's second part of his question, he's a big Ryan Mallett guy.
Yeah.
Wonders what his future is here. I don't know. I think you're stretching a little bit, Lauren, to say he's Flacco part two.
Yeah.
I think that's a stretch on Ryan Mallett. I like Ryan too, and he definitely proved himself against the Steelers. But, you know, he had a rough offseason last year. There's no two ways of putting it. I mean, it was tough. He bounced back in the preseason, played pretty well, and beat out Josh Johnson in what was a legitimate quarterback competition, I think, for the number two spot. Now, I think you can kind of tell where Mallett's stock is league-wide in that this year it's not like people were banging down the door for trade offers or to sign him in free agency. He was a free agent that the Ravens brought back.
Yeah.
So I don't think he's really in the future long-term plans. I don't really think that a team is probably going to want to trade for him, especially because he likely won't see any action this year. So I think he's probably more of a short-term option. Maybe they could re-sign him again if he plays well in the preseason and whatever, is a good teammate and all that stuff during the season. But I don't think he's a long-term kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'll eventually draft somebody that I think can keep around,
I mean,
for cheaper.
Flacco's eventual replacement
isn't
on the roster right now.
No.
You know,
no,
it's
no,
not like...
Definitely not.
It's not like you're grooming somebody to take over for him. Joe still has 5 years left on his contract. Joe is the short-term and long-term answer. You don't think really beyond 5 years in the NFL.
Exactly.
And so that's where it stands right now at quarterback. It's going to be number five for a long time coming.
Yeah. So with that, let's jump right into our interview, or my interview, with Benjamin Watson. We've been wanting to get you on the pod for a while because you're one of the most interesting guys on the team from a lot of different perspectives. So I want to start out first. You're doing the rounds right now with your book, and we're about a month since it first hit shelves, The New Dad's Playbook.
Yeah.
And obviously the first question is, why did you want to write a book about being a dad?
Well, because I am a dad of five, actually. We have five children, 3 girls, 2 boys. The oldest is 8, the youngest is 1. We waited 3 years before we decided to have kids, and then we went like straight 2-minute drill and just popped out. Well, my wife popped out. Four kids in 4.5 years, and then we waited and had another one. But about after the second kid or so, she said, Benjamin, you should write a handbook for dads. Talking about fatherhood, talking about really talking about conception up into the birth, up until, you know, the few months after the baby gets home and you have your new family, and just things to expect, because guys work best when we have information that empowers us. So
right.
There's a lot of medical terms in there, talking about, you know, the birth and what to expect when you go to the OB appointment, and how do you buy maternity clothes, and what to expect when you hear the heartbeat, and it sounds like a little radio in there, and you know, you see the ultrasound, all the terms that you hear when it comes to the trimesters and everything through pregnancy. But then there's also the challenge of fatherhood, that's encouraging guys that they have what it takes to be the men, the husbands, the fathers that they're called to be. So one of the reasons, well, the primary reason for writing the book is to encourage men, because we live in a world where, really in a country where, you know, 33% of our kids are growing up without a father in their home. Mm-hmm. And while mothers do an amazing job playing both roles sometimes, there needs to be a father there if at all possible. Right. And so many things are linked to a father being absent. That it's imperative that men, young men, older men, maybe if you had a child and you weren't there for that one, you want to be here for the second one, whatever it may be, whether you're first, second, third kid, the encouragement there is to be present, not just by sending your money or by paying for certain things, but by having your body, your person present there and engaging with your children, because the next generation depends on it so much.
Right. Yeah, I think as a society, we're talking so much about how do we help people who are in need, you know, lower income people in poverty and whatnot. And it's just not just those people who don't have fathers. It's everybody. But
it's everybody.
I think everybody on both sides of the aisle can agree the more good fathers that we have in this world to go along with great mothers, the better off that we're going
to
be.
Very true. Very true. And you talk to guys, you know, being in the locker room for the last 13 years, you know, I'm around countless young men. Yep. Myself included. And so we have these conversations. A lot of times people think all we talk about is football, and that's true, but we talk about a lot of other stuff too. Yeah. And as I remember being the younger player, my first, second, third year, we didn't have kids. My fourth year, we didn't have children. And asking guys who had kids what it was like being a parent. I mean, I had parents. I'm the oldest of six, but it's a whole nother animal when you are responsible for somebody's life. Right. You know what I mean? Yep. And so I remember all those questions. And so part of the book, The New Dad's Playbook, is answering a lot of those questions. Everything from, you know, how does sex and intimacy change?
You know, throughout the pregnancy. Guess what chapter I opened to first?
You opened to that one?
Because I'm like, all right, let's check out that one.
And the funny thing is, with that chapter specifically, I'm sitting on the bed with my wife Kirsten, I'm like, babe, you know, what do I need to put in this book? She said, you know, you need to put something in there about how sex changes during different parts of the pregnancy,
right.
When to ask, when not to ask, how to serve, how not to serve.
And she's like, you ask me right now.
Exactly. So, I mean, but those are like real questions that we talk about as men, and that I want guys to be able to parent and to serve the mother of their children the way they need to be supported throughout this whole process.
Yeah, I got to ask you. So I have a 14-month-old, a little boy, Brooks. And I got to ask you, because everybody always asks me this question, did you watch during the birth? Were you down there? Did you see the whole thing happen?
Did you?
I did. I tell people you got to see it. I think it's a miracle. I think it's amazing.
I did too, but that's one of the questions guys have. You know, it's kind of funny, but you know, people want to know, should I watch? Should I not watch? Right. You know, I remember my wife was pregnant with our first, and I remember being at practice in New England, it being late in the year. My daughter was born in January, so it was late in the year, and I remember asking one of my teammates. He was a running back. He had three kids, and I was like, Sammy, you know, did you watch? And he's like, no, I didn't watch. He's like, man, I if I watched, it would be totally different. I'd be ruined. I can never look at my wife the same way. So I didn't watch for any of them. Then I asked another one of my teammates. He's like, yeah, of course I watched. You know, just like you said, it was, you know, it's a miracle. I got to watch my kids come into the world, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I did watch for all five of them. Uh-huh. And actually, I got more involved the further along it got, nice. Like with more kids. So the first two, I simply watched. The first three, I simply watched. But by the time we got to number four, I was the one assisting the baby into the world, out of the birth canal.
That's
I was
cool.
More and more involved. You know, so I definitely wanted to see my children come to the world.
Right. Another funny story from the book that I'll share before we move on is I thought you were talking about like a birthing gift. What's it called? It's a push present. Push present.
Yeah, push present, man.
And you had a funny story in the book about the push present that you gave Kirsten that got you a little bit of a, it got you a letter in the mail from the NFL. You got to tell the story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, well, not exactly a push present, but definitely like a
a shout out?
A shout out, a push shout out almost. So it was 2009, we were on the road and kind of one of those trips where, you know, being an East Coast team in New England and we were playing, I believe, Seattle and Oakland. Uh-huh. So we stayed out there for 2 weeks. Well, Kirsten's 9 months pregnant with our first child. I score a touchdown in Seattle and I knew she's watching. I look at the camera, put the ball under my shirt like I was pregnant and just rubbed it and pointed at the camera, smiling. Everything was fun, you know. The referee, of course, throws the flag out because I'm using the ball as a prop.
Right.
And, you know, in the NFL, if you ever get a FedEx envelope on a Wednesday, it's not anything positive usually.
Right.
So I got fined $10,000 by the National Football League. They rescinded half of it, so it ended up being $5,000, but it still was an expensive shout out. It was worth it, but I never did it again with any of the other kids. But the push present is important, though. It's kind of this cult thing that's going on.
Yeah.
You don't have to do it. It could be anything, you know.
My wife has gotten push presents of like breakfast every morning since we had the baby. I think every single morning. That's her push present.
Exactly. It's just kind of the acknowledgement that, hey, you know, you did something really amazing, and I want to honor you for it.
Yeah, really difficult. Yeah. and so this isn't your first time as an author. You also wrote Under Our Skin, which really tackled race in our country. And you wrote it. It was released, and you wrote it right after Ferguson and all that stuff happened.
Yeah, it was released. So Ferguson happened in 2014, and the book came out in 2015.
Right. So, I mean, what can you say about, I know it's a broad question, but about how kind of race has become a huge topic in our country and a very, difficult topic to address from both sides of the aisle, kind of. Where have you seen things change?
Well, race is at the core of who we are as a country.
Yeah.
When you look at our history, 10 years back, 20 years back, 200 years back, whatever it may be, that's always kind of been the common thread, how we deal with different people groups.
Right.
And so it's something that has never gone away. It's changed, obviously, for the better, I believe, in a lot of areas, but it's something that keeps on coming up. And it's something, like you said before, is very, very difficult to talk about because now we're in a time where, you know, we're scared to say certain things. We don't want to be labeled, even if our questions are genuine sometimes. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be labeled a bigot or racist. And so many of us, instead of engaging with each other, we stick to our corners. And especially when a certain racially motivated event happens, like a Ferguson, you really see how polarizing it can be and how we get in our corners and we really don't discuss anything because we have a certain group think that we have to identify with. We feel compelled to identify with.
Right.
And so my whole point with with Under Our Skin and even in writing that Facebook post that people read and kind of led to the book was about being honest about it. You know, saying, you know, I'm angry that this stuff is happening, but I also can try to see another side of it. Right. I also know that I don't know all the facts all the time.
Right.
And I want to be someone who is my allegiance to be the truth and not necessarily to my upbringing or the color of my skin.
Right.
You know, because of the color of our skin, or really it's one color, the shade of our skin, the shade of brown that all of our skin is, we feel that we have to think a certain way sometimes, even if it's wrong. And so the whole point of Under Our Skin is to say, you know, we have an issue with this, let's talk about it, let's be real about it, let's lay it bare, let's address it from all sides, and let's have an allegiance to truth and not just what we think is popular for us to say because of our backgrounds.
Yeah, I think that's what's really interesting about you. What's always struck me as interesting is you're a black man.
Yeah.
But you sometimes, I feel like, have political viewpoints that aren't generally associated with a black man your age.
Or, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
You, and I would imagine that leads to some very interesting conversations in the locker room.
It does.
Yeah.
it does sometimes. But no, it's not even. But see, the thing is, like, even in the locker room, it does lead to some interesting conversations. But because we have relationships in the locker room, or we know each other, we know that most of the time we're not being malicious.
Yeah.
And we understand that although we may disagree politically or about something about religion or something about a social issue, we can still respect each other and still love each other.
Yeah.
And that's what's missing, especially in the social media culture. And in our culture in general, is that a lot of times we don't have a relationship with anybody that's different from us economically or with our ethnicity. And so it makes it hard to have these types of conversations and still have respect for the person and still love the person.
Right.
Because we just see them as somebody that's totally different with nothing in common, and it doesn't care about us and is out to get us. Now, sometimes that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's very true. But a lot of times it's not. But until we have an intentional relationship with somebody that's different than us, and I say intentional because you have to be intentional about reaching out and having a conversation and forging a relationship with someone that you probably wouldn't normally have a relationship with. That's why I love the locker room, is because you got guys in there from Podunk, Idaho, to inner city, wherever.
Right.
Guys who were raised on a farm, guys who, you know, go hunting all the time, guys who've never picked up a gun.
Right.
I mean, it runs the gamut.
Right.
And you still, even in that bubble, you have to still be intentional, because you can still go about your day and never really talk about anything important.
Yeah.
But I think it lends itself, if you're willing to having those conversations. I mean, some of the best conversations ever have been in locker rooms, and then we're like, no, I don't agree with that. No, you're crazy. Are you serious about that? That's racist. That's not racist. How could you say that? But then we forgive each other and we say, okay, well, you know, we disagree to disagree on that.
Right. So who have you had the best conversations with, political conversations with in the locker room?
Well, I've had, he's not here anymore, but Forsett. And we agree on a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Some things we don't agree on, but we have a relationship there where we can talk about certain things.
Yeah.
I had another teammate in New Orleans, a guy named Zach Streif.
Yeah.
And we have conversations with him about race. He's a big white guy, offensive tackle, you know, but we would talk.
Did he like to hunt?
I don't think he did. I don't think he was a hunter. I don't think he was a hunter, but he was very willing to engage in these types of conversations.
Yeah.
And the thing is especially with Ferguson, and I actually write about him in my book,
yeah,
because he has a niece whose father is black.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of things that he didn't see before, when she was born, it all of a sudden became real to him.
Wow.
And so we would talk about these things, and he would say, yeah, I just didn't think about it until it actually touched me personally.
Yeah.
And you know, so that's the hope, is that you have empathy for people that are different, even if you don't understand, you know, exactly what they're going through.
Yeah, and speaking of that, you just got back not too long ago from a trip to Lebanon, where I'm sure your empathy for the whole refugee situation just probably went through the roof, seeing it firsthand. Can you just talk about, you know, your work over there and how it changed you?
Yeah, it came out of the blue from a pastor from a church we've been going to here in Columbia, Maryland, asking me to go to Lebanon, and I'm thinking, go where? Like, I am in rehab. I don't have time to go to Lebanon. But it was a short trip because he didn't want to miss a Sunday, so really we were there for 5 days, including travel. So really it was awesome for me with the kids, and my wife was saying, you know, you need to go. I have a feeling that, you know, this is an opportunity that you may not get. So basically we met up with World Vision, which is a large humanitarian organization. And for the 3 days we were there, we spent time in the Bekaa Valley, which is, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, which is right on the border of Syria, which is where a lot of these refugee camps, but they call them informal tenant settlements, are. They're on a lot of the agricultural land there. And so we spent time in some of the camps, had a chance to sit down in a tent with a Syrian family, and hear their story through an interpreter. You know, everybody speaks Arabic, so everything was through an interpreter. But just talking about the fact that they were in their home and their home was blown up, and they just ran out with basically the clothes that they had on, a husband and wife, they had kids. One of the guys had been shot, and they traveled over the mountains into Lebanon. They've been there for about 5 years now.
Gosh.
And so this crisis has been going on for I want to say about 6 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spent time doing that, seeing what World Vision did as far as providing clean water in these camps, latrines, you know, toilets, different sanitation, providing food for them. And really the thing that struck me the most was sitting in that tent on the floor, as it's a tradition, talking to this family and hearing them say, you know, when we go to bed at night, we just dream that we wake up and we're back home in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what
these people don't want to be living like this.
They don't.
Right.
Not at all.
They don't want to be refugees.
And looking, you know, taking it back to fatherhood, you know, looking at these men in their eye, the fact that they are having a hard time providing for their kids,
mm-hmm.
but they want to provide for the kids the same way that I do.
Right.
And being able to just encourage them and say, you know what, I respect what you're trying to do for your children, trying to provide a life for your children. The children have a hard time going to school. World Vision provides some sort of childhood education for them. We saw a lot of the way that they developed the infrastructure of the host country as well as for the refugees there. But that was what really struck me was that, you know, these people are from another country. They're from Syria. We're from the United States. We were Christians. They were Muslims. Totally different traditions, but as men, as fathers, looking across, you know, the floor to each other, and able to say, you know, as a dad, you know, I feel your struggle.
Right.
You know,
right.
I don't know what it is, but I feel your struggle, and we will be praying for you and advocating for you as much as we can. And so, right. It really was an encouraging trip. I had a chance to stay in Beirut for a little bit and meet with the pastor there, who does a lot of work in what's one of the largest neighborhoods in the Middle East, and talked about how he hears threats from ISIS on his phone, and how people in his community are threatened by them. But just to see the resiliency, even of the refugees, the hope that they have, and also the way that the Lebanese were serving these Syrian citizens, right. Who not too long ago, Syria was occupying Lebanon.
Right.
So you have that dynamic of
have definitely some hostility there.
Exactly.
Right.
And they were talking about how it was hard for them to do that, but they wanted to help people.
Right.
And so, I mean, you know, Lebanon has, I think, 5.5 million people, something like that. You know, not a whole lot of people, but there's over 1.5 million refugees. So right. It'd kind of be like if like 100 million people just showed up in the United States over the course of the next 5 years. How will we deal with that?
Right.
So just
and
really
you hope
just,
that we would deal with it the way that the Lebanese are.
Yeah, but and it's complex.
Yeah.
I walked away feeling like, man, I wish this whole Syrian thing, I could just wish it away, this crisis. But it's very, very complex, and it affects a lot of other surrounding countries, not only surrounding countries, but countries around the world.
Yeah. Well, I think all your off-field stuff is really awesome. Yeah. I really do. With that said, we probably should talk some football.
Yeah, we should. Yeah, I think people want to hear some football.
People do want to hear about that. I can talk about this for like an hour with you.
They're like, this is not CNN or Fox. Can we talk some football?
All right. So you're coming off the Achilles, and people want to know how it's going for you.
Yeah. It's going well. It's a very tough process. I felt very, very disappointed.
Yeah.
Maybe not devastated long term, but very, very disappointed coming here, moving my family from New Orleans, having excitement about being here in Baltimore. Every time you go to a new city, you have to earn respect of fans, earn respect of your teammates. You want to prove that you can play the game and you can contribute. Mm-hmm. And watching this year was one of the toughest things I've ever done. Mm-hmm. I went to the games. I would go to the games. As soon as I was mobile, I would go to the home games. I was on my scooter, pushing myself on the scooter.
Right.
And then I went to crutches. Then I went to the walking boot. Mm-hmm. So I went through the course, but I made it to all the home games because I wanted to at least be there, but it was very hard to watch. So I'm nearing the end of the rehab, kind of the last little bit where you really got to get the calf stronger because it turns into like a little string bean. Your whole leg just disappears because you can't use it. but this rehab, I've had a number of surgeries. I think I counted about 7 of them. Mm. But this one is this rehab is definitely the toughest. But I am getting stronger every day and looking forward to being back.
How much have you talked to Steve Smith about this whole thing, considering he also went through the
Achilles? Yeah, I probably text with Steve probably every few weeks. The last text was about 4 days ago. Didn't know who's going to show up today, but it was a few days ago, and just asking him what was it like around month 8, month 9, when you're getting close and you're still trying to get that spring back, and he always has some good encouraging words. I mean, he always reaffirms that just keep on pushing, man, keep on pushing.
And obviously, with Dennis Pitta tragically going down with his hip injury, everybody's talking about you, and saying it'd be huge if Benjamin Watson stepped up and could fill that role that Dennis did last year. Mm-hmm. Just what do you say to people about that? I mean, how confident do you feel like coming off of this that you can be an impact player this season?
Well, that's why I'm rehabbing.
Yeah.
If I didn't think I could play, if I didn't have the desire to play, then, at this point in time in my career, I would have walked off into the sunset, right? Yeah. So the goal is to get back, and the goal is to be the player that I was, a player that can contribute, the player that can help us win games. Right. I was it's kind of weird because, you know, I come here last year, Dennis had an injury, I come here, I have an injury, then he plays, now he has an injury.
Right.
It's the nature of the game. And it really, being at practice when Dennis went down, I wasn't practicing, so I was able to go over to him and actually get under his arm, me and a trainer, and carry him into the training room. And I felt so terrible for him, mm-hmm. because I know how hard it is to come back from injury. I know how much work we put into this. I know how we dedicate ourselves to our craft and how emotionally we get tied into doing this because this is what we love to do. And to see another guy who I respect tremendously as a player and a person go through that, because I know what it feels like, it hurt to see that.
Yeah.
You know, the whole weekend I'm sitting there thinking like, Lord, I'm just praying like, hopefully he gets to the doctor and it's not as bad as right. you think it is.
Right.
Even though that's what he was telling us as we were carrying him in, and so, you know, it's unfortunate. And I kept thinking about when I got hurt, and I tore my Achilles. And they carry me into the locker room, and they sit me on the table. And I didn't know this until I sat on the table and turned around, and Steve was standing right
wow.
there. He had followed me in because he knew what it was, and he knew how it felt. And he sat there with me for a long time. We shed tears, and he sat there and encouraged me because he knew what I was about to go through. And right. so, you know, I my heart goes out to Dennis. But, you know, this year my goal is to come back and play. Right. I mean, that's what it's always been. A lot of times guys say they don't want to go out like that, you know, having an injury. And I do feel that. But more importantly, I feel like I have unfinished business, you know, with this team.
Right. Awesome. Well, we're all rooting for you.
Appreciate
Thank
it,
you
man.
For talking to me. Appreciate
all right, man.
It, man. All right. Well, thanks again to Benjamin. Really good stuff. I mean, you talk about interesting people on this roster. He's one of the most interesting guys that there is, not only just on the Ravens roster, but I mean, one of the more interesting guys I've really ever met. A guy with a big heart, strong in his convictions, but willing to learn and learn more about the world and change his viewpoints if needed, I think, on some issues. So I think that's really cool. I have a lot of respect for him. And just before I close this thing out, on the topic of tight ends, just give you a quick take here, because in Mailbag, Garrett and I taped it this week, and the question was, what's the best competition that's remaining? And I think it is tight end. That obviously includes Benjamin. And it's going to be really interesting, because I think that you don't really know what's going to come from Benjamin. He still has a ways to go in his recovery. You look at Nick Boyle, probably he's got the leg up as the starter. He and Crockett Gilmore, as of now, not knowing what Benjamin is going to be like when training camp rolls around in the preseason. So Nick Boyle, Crockett Gilmore, Darren Waller, I still think has some room to grow, but a very high ceiling. So you have some interesting players. Max Williams, his knee, I don't know how that's going to turn out. It's a surgery that's never been done before to a football player. When you hear that, doesn't sound like it's going to be anytime soon. So he'd have a comeback effort for sure if he were going to factor in this season, I think. So really interesting stuff coming up in the tight end competition, and we'll have all the updates for you. And the lounge is not going anywhere. It's summer vacation time, but we will still be here, still be delivering episodes. So make sure you keep it tuned in. And as always, you can reach us at thelounge@ravens.nfl.net. We'll be back with you soon enough.